Welcome back, Question Medicine 2020. That's right, 2020. I just cannot get used to saying that for the life of me. OMG, OMG. All right, here we go. Question Medicine 2020. I am back. Andrew Bilt, sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. You know the deal by now. Another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. It is time to talk about what I'm talking about, what I'm getting on, what I'm thinking about, what I'm reading about, and what I'm going through. So, without further ado, without any hesitation, and wait, hold on a second. Again, this is the second episode of Question Medicine 2.0, which means I'm adding new things. I'm trying to work on the sound quality. There's a lot of things that I'm adjusting for 2020, for what I want to be the new wave of Question Medicine, how I'm kind of envisioning the podcast. If you like some of these things, please let me know. Andrew Bilt, B-U-E-L-T, at gmail.com. If you don't like it, that's okay. You're not going to hurt my feelings. I promise I can take it. But shoot me an email and let me know, what can I change? How can I make it better for you, the listener, to make it more pleasurable, more enjoyable? Something that tickles the clitoris of your neuronal membranes. I once had an attending tell me that, and I looked at him and said, what are you talking about? There is no clitoris in the neuronal membranes. I looked through the entire netters, couldn't find it, wasn't there. And he said, yes, I know, but everyone knows that if you tickle the clitoris of the neuronal membranes, you will stimulate an orgasm, and no one forgets an orgasm. So I just want to give you an orgasm of your neuronal membranes. And with that, without for any further hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, Question Medicine 2020, Andrew Bilt, sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. You know the deal by now. Here we go. Let's kick it off. And we're going to start with a viewpoint. That's something I have actually never, ever, ever done on Question Medicine. And it's something I want to do new because, realistically, there are no new ideas out there at all. It's all taken from somewhere else, somewhere at some time. It's just whether they actually wrote it down or not. But somebody has thought of whatever you're thinking about at some point or time in some manner or shape or form. And the article I want to talk about is called Refocusing Medicare Prior Authorization on Its Intended Purposes. Prior authorization, yes, that's right. That's what I want to talk about. Can you think of a more boring topic? Well, here's the deal. Prior authorization requirements increase from 8% to approximately 24% of covered drugs for Medicare between 2007 and 2019. That's a huge increase. And prior authorization for commercial formularies increased from 35% to 67% from 2011 to 2016. In 2017, the 35% that were initially rejected from Medicare Part D, upon appeal, 73% were actually accepted, which means that they're just denying them for fun, for giggles, for, I mean, come on, when you have 35% that are rejected, but then ultimately of those 73% are approved, it means realistically your baseline number should have been maybe a denial rate of only 15%. But instead, you have providers do all this excess paperwork just to see if they'll do it. I mean, that is a crock of crumola. It's a bunch of bullshit. Meyer Wiener, you know what I'm trying to say. It is ridiculous, and they do it because they know one of two things will happen. Either one, we won't do the prior authorization, which is probably possibly true, or two, the patient is stuck in limbo. They're stuck either calling the provider, saying, hey, fill out this form, then calling the pharmacy and say, hey, is my script ready yet? And then calling back to the provider, and then calling back to the pharmacy, and they're stuck in limbo, and 37% of prescriptions that are initially rejected at the pharmacy are abandoned, never picked up by the patient. So ultimately, the insurance company doesn't have to pay for them because one-third of them that are initially denied are never picked up. This viewpoint gives an awesome solution, not just one, but three solutions. So let's go over those one by one. First, solution number one. Insurance plans need to eliminate prior authorization or authorization requirements for medications that have very final denial rates. If the final denial rate is super low, meaning even if you deny it the first time, you almost always accept it once there's a prior authorization, just throw those out. Those need to be gotten rid of. Number two, we have to protect the continuity of patient care because patients are on these medications year after year, year after year, year after year, and then sometimes they either go to a new insurance or that same insurance requires a new prior authorization every year, even though the patient's been on the medication for 600 years. Why do they need a new prior authorization? Their chronic condition of rheumatoid arthritis has not suddenly changed. They don't suddenly not need the medication. No, they need the medication. And when they switch insurances, they shouldn't have to go back to step one of, oh, you need to try all these baseline rheumatoid arthritis drugs before you give the other one, even though you failed it on the other insurance. There needs to be a continuity of patient care and a continuation of the drugs because really these drugs are helping the patients get better and live their lives. And number three, last but not least, there has to be a transparency, efficacy, fairness. It's technology. We're 2020 right now. How do we not have a computer system that tells us what's formulary for every single insurance? And better yet, how have none of the electronic medical records implemented a database that says, oh, hey, this patient has Blue Cross or this blue patient has United or this patient has whatever you want to be. I don't know. I don't care. But for them, formulary actually is this medication and not this one. Because the worst thing is when you get the prior authorization or you get the call and it says, well, that one's not on their formulary. And okay, what is on their formulary? And then you have to redo it or re-answer that for what's on their formulary. And you can't expect us all to know what is on every single insurance plan's formulary. It's just not realistic. It's not fair. And it should easily be changed. Again, it's 2020. I mean, come on, man. All right. End of viewpoint. We all know there are problems. I do like some of the solutions. And it's just important to bring the topic up, mention it, so that way we all know we can talk about it. Talk about it around the water cooler, about potential solutions, because just maybe, if we start talking about it, that's how solutions and problems get fixed. Now, on to the next article. The next article is titled, Risk of Nephrogenic Systemic Fibrosis in Patients with Stage 4 or 5 Kidney Disease Receiving a Group 2 Gadolinium-Based Contrast Agent, a Systematic Review, and Meta-analysis. I looked at this article as well as the accompanying editorial. And let's start with a little history lesson, shall we please? Because in the 1990s and early 2000s, lots of patients with chronic kidney disease were exposed to gadolinium-based contrast agents for contrast-enhanced MRIs. And we thought this was so much safer than a CT scan and CT contrast, and the risk of contrast induced nephropathy would be super low. So this was an awesome test. We're going to get these contrast MRIs. Unfortunately, as I have not said recently, but I say all the time, with every in, there's an out. With every up, there's a down. When the tides roll in, they have to roll back out. Well, sadly, a couple people developed nephrogenic systemic fibrosis when they were getting these new fancy wonderful CT contrast gadolinium-based MRIs. The patients with this nephrogenic systemic fibrosis experience insane morbidity and irreversible systemic fibrotic changes and a super high mortality. I didn't know anything about this. I had to Google it. Ugh. And I could see how just having one of these patients on your service and you order the MRI would give you PTSD. If you don't know what I'm talking about, and that's okay if you don't, look it up. Again, stop the podcast, go look it up, nephrogenic systemic fibrosis. But because of this, it led to a black box warning in 2007 because they said, look at these cases. We have to stop it here. But luckily in 2010, the FDA was smart enough and they came out and they updated their gadolinium warning to specify that it is only three agents that we need to worry about. And those three agents are absolutely impossible to pronounce. So if you want to know what they are, click on the details of this podcast and just scroll into the notes of this podcast. And I have those three agents listed. But I'm not going to say them on the air because I will absolutely slaughter them. So they said, these three agents, these are the really bad ones. And they cleared all other agents, all other gadolinium agents could be used but should be used cautiously. Because what else are they going to say? That it's absolutely fiction free, don't worry about it, sunny boy, you're good to go? Absolutely not. Of course, they're going to say, use them cautiously. Well, in case that wasn't good enough and we needed a different answer, then we got group two agents. Remember, previously, we had group one agents. They weren't so good. Now we have group two agents, because once you have group one, what are you going to do next? You're going to get group two. So group two agents, which I also can't pronounce, but I will post in the show notes below, which if you want to see what those are, just click on the details of this episode in your app and it will tell you all the information, as it does for every show, including links to all the articles that I talk about. But back to the subject at hand, in this study, in this meta-analysis, back to this actual paper, they took 5,000 patients, stage 4 and 5 CKD, receiving group 2, yes, the group 2 gadolinium agents, and included patients undergoing dialysis. And they reported, guess how many episodes? Guess how many episodes of this nephrogenic systemic fibrosis? If you guess zero, you would be correct. Absolutely zero. They reported a zero pooled incidence of unconfounded nephrogenic systemic fibrosis. Now, I will admit, we don't know out of those 5,000 how many people were on dialysis, which has the highest risk. Obviously, the sicker you are, the more severe your kidney injury is, the higher risk you are to ultimately get the badness of the disease. But we can't ignore the fact that out of 5,000 patients, not a single case report occurred. So with that being said, I think that we can safely say that if your patient needs a contrast-enhanced MRI and they have kidney disease, just order a group 2 gadolinium agent. And I will tell you, at almost every center that you call or every hospital, and you should probably call your radiology department, I called mine, it's absolutely standard that they get group 2. It's not even an option to get group 1. They don't even allow that to be a possibility. So realistically, at your shop or wherever you work, it's probably automatically going to already be group 2 and you don't have to think twice. But in case you're worried, just call down, ask for group 2. And if you want to try to pronounce them, again, you can, but they're really hard to pronounce and I wouldn't try it if I were you. And in case you are nervous and you're still thinking to yourself, well, I don't really know if this is for me, have no fear. The American College of Radiology guidelines state that, and I quote, group 2 agents can safely be used in patients with advanced chronic kidney disease and those receiving dialysis, provided that they receive dialysis after exposure. Here's what I say. If your patient is getting dialysis, they're going to get dialysis after exposure. It does not say that they need dialysis immediately after exposure. They just need dialysis. Well, every dialysis patient gets dialysis either Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. So have no fear. They're going to get it after the exposure. It doesn't have to be immediately. They just have to get it. And yep, that was the horn. That was the horn of the ship leaving the dock. And you might be saying to yourself, wait a second. In the last podcast, you said that was going to be the warning sign. This was the last article I'm going to talk about. Well, it is kind of the last article I'm getting ready to talk about, even though we're so early in this podcast, because it's the last topic I'm going to talk about. I'm going to spend the rest of this podcast talking about nutrition, and because there has been a whole bunch of literature that has all come out on nutrition, and I think it's important to address and important to talk about why it's so wrong. So let's just touch on some of the articles, shall we? The first article we're going to hit on is an article in the BMJ titled Healthy Lifestyles and Life Expectancy Free of Cancer, Cardiovascular Disease, and Type 2 Diabetes, a Prospective Cohort Study. This cohort study used data from the Nurses' Health Study and the Health Professionals Follow-Up Study to look at the association between low-risk lifestyle factors, five of them, and life expectancy free of cardiovascular disease, cancer, and diabetes. The five lifestyle risk factors that they included were moderate alcohol intake, having a higher diet quality score, never smoking, having a body mass index between 18.5 and 24.9, and engaging in moderate to vigorous physical activity for at least 30 minutes per day. when you looked at women age 50 years old, those individuals who adopted none of those healthy lifestyle factors had life expectancies free of cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and cancer of about 24 years. But if you adopted four of those five, well, then you had life expectancy free of cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and cancer of about 34 years. So basically what I'm saying is if you adopted a healthy lifestyle, well, then you had 24 more years expected before you would either die, get diabetes, or get cancer. And if you adopted four out of the five healthy lifestyles, then you had 34 years. So you gained 10 extra years of cancer-free, diabetes-free, and cardiovascular disease-free life just by adopting. So basically this study just says what we already know, and probably what you should talk with your patients the most about is adopting these healthy lifestyles. Who really cares about their statins, their vitamin D, their... Who cares about most of the things that they're coming in with if you're not talking to them about these healthy lifestyles, which are moderate alcohol intake, having a higher diet quality score, meaning eating healthy, never smoking, having a body mass index between 18.5 and 24.9, and engaging in moderate to vigorous physical activity for at least 30 minutes per day. Well, if you are not talking to them about that, then what are you doing? And when you're talking to your patient about what healthy lifestyles they should probably obtain in their life or start to follow in their life, one of those was a healthy diet. Well, let's look at this next article in JAMA Internal Medicine titled Association of Low Carbohydrate and Low Fat Diets with Mortality Among U.S. Adults. This was a prospective cohort study that analyzed data from the U.S. National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. And they looked at just over 37,000 adults from 1999 to 2014. Now, as I said, this was a nutrition examination survey. So the survey, which was just a survey, that's one of the flaws. But again, you can't randomize long-term data on diet exercise. You can't randomize people to eat what you want to eat unless you deliver food to the door. So surveys are always the best we're going to get whenever it comes to the dietary studies. In this survey, it provided 24-hour dietary recall data for adults 20 years of age and older. And then they looked at the quality of low-carbohydrate diets and low-fat diets based on the macronutrient energy percentage within each diet. So if you said, oh, I have fruit, well, that is a form of carbohydrate, but the macronutrient there is a lot different than the carbohydrate that if you said I had a Twinkie. And so then they based your healthy diet based on the macronutrients in the survey of the food that you filled out. And ultimately, they were looking at the association, or was there mortality tied to worst dietary scores among the U.S. population that they surveyed? And in the end, well, it showed that if you had a low-fat diet, you were no different than a low-carbohydrate diet. So those of you out there that are saying, oh, you must be low-fat, oh, you must be low-carbohydrate, well, this study would say, at least when it comes to mortality, you're completely wrong. However, there was a connection between the better quality of carbohydrates and the better quality of fats and the lower total mortality. What am I saying there? I'm saying that basically if you ate really crummy being like cookie carbohydrates, or you ate really bad fats being like two and four-legged animals compared to plants and fish fats, well then you are more likely to die. But even that is a little suspect, and wait until the last article of this podcast when I really unfold the good and bad of four-legged animals versus fish and chicken. In fact, this study found that those individuals that had refined grains and added sugars compared to those individuals who ate carbs from whole vegetables, fruits, and grains, well, there was a 16% difference in the mortality, which goes to say that it's not necessarily energy in and energy out, as we would all think that it should be when it comes to diet and exercise. It might actually matter what the energy going in is, and maybe even matters what the energy coming out is. I'm not going to get into that too much, but I will say that this study, as well as all nutrition data, have their inherent flaws. And then they have not only the inherent flaws, but the flaws that are created by the authors. So it's not the end-all be-all, but it is certainly worth saying that if you're going to have the discussion with your patient anyways about diet and exercise, you might as well have a conversation with them, not necessarily about a low-carb or a low-fat or a low-anything diet, but about eating a healthy diet. And speaking of eating, there was a recent study that just came out that looked at does eating matter when it comes to your chronic disease? Does eating matter when it comes to your prostate cancer? Well, in this study in JAMA, they took almost 500 men with prostate cancer, stage 2 or less, and then they randomized them to one of two groups, either to counseling behavioral intervention by telephone, promoting consumption of 7 or more daily vegetables servings, or a control group, which just received written information about diet and prostate cancer. And then they took the primary outcome, which was the progression. And the progression did not differ significantly between the two groups. Surprise, surprise, if you are thinking that maybe, just maybe, eating way more fruits and vegetables is going to do you so much better when you have prostate cancer, it's going to limit the progression of disease, well, you're probably wrong. However, the study doesn't say you can eat anything, and ultimately, I think even if you're given written information or you're called about being told about having 7 or more doses of vegetables, you're probably going to eat more vegetables just because you're being told it in one form or another. And B, again, this doesn't say you can eat Twinkies, Ho-Hos, Dum-Dums, Lollipops. But it is saying that if you think there's going to be a protective effect with the food that you're eating for prostate cancer, it's likely not seen. And last but not least, the last article, which I'm going to break down in almost annoying detail because it just goes to show how bad the nutrition data is. It's in a paper titled Association of Processed Meat, Unprocessed Red Meat, Poultry, or Fish Intake with Incident Cardiovascular Disease and All-Cause Mortality. In case you can't tell from the title, this is looking at basically all kinds of meat, red meat, chicken, and fish. And then what about the incident or the first cardiovascular disease or all-cause mortality event? What happens with this association? Now, if you just read the summary, you will find that these findings suggest that among U.S. adults, higher intake of processed meat, unprocessed meat, or poultry, but not fish, was significantly associated with a small increased risk of incident cardiovascular disease, whereas higher intake of processed meat or unprocessed red meat, but not chicken or fish, was significantly associated with a small increased risk of all-cause mortality. Basically, what they're saying is, if you eat fish, you're going to have a decreased risk, or at least less risk than if you ate red meat or chicken for the cardiovascular disease. But then don't worry, fish and chicken are okay if you're just looking at all-cause mortality. This must be really good data, right? This is that headline-grabbing newspaper Washington Post headline of, look at this study, they found that if you eat red meat, you are going to die soon. Well, maybe, just maybe, or maybe not. Let's look at the data, and what does this study actually say when you actually read the article? Well, there were almost 30,000 participants, and the follow-up was right around 19 years. There were two primary outcomes, which were the incident of cardiovascular disease or all-cause mortality. The primary dietary exposures were processed meat, unprocessed red meat, poultry, or fish. And fish included shellfish. And to determine how much of this food they had eaten, they gave all the participants a food frequency questionnaire. And they tried to determine how many servings you had of each one. One serving was equivalent to 4 ounces of unprocessed red meat or chicken, 3 ounces of fish. And then for the processed meat, one serving consisted of 2 slices of bacon or 2 small links of sausage or 1 hot dog. And let's be serious here. If only one serving is 2 slices of bacon, then you can go ahead and count me in for at least 12 servings every single weekend. But with that being said, let's look at the data. First, they looked at the incident or the initial cardiovascular disease event. And if you had processed meat, which was, you know, obviously as we go back, the slices of bacon, the sausage, or the hot dog, 2 of those versus no servings per week, you had an increased risk, an increased hazard ratio of 1.07. Yeah, that's right. You were 7 times more likely to develop a cardiovascular event, a cardiovascular disease. And if you had unprocessed red meat consumed during the week, well, then Again, you still had an increased hazard ratio, 1.03, with a confidence interval almost touching 1, almost touching not significant, but the confidence interval was 1.01, so just barely not hitting significance. That finding was also true for chicken. Again, 2 servings in a week, well then, your incident cardiovascular disease hazard ratio 1.04, and again, the confidence interval at 1.01, almost not significant, almost, but when you're digging for data, you gotta find something. But the thing that they did find here was, wait for it, if you had 2 servings of fish per week, well then, OMG, that was it. There was no significant association with cardiovascular disease with 2 servings of fish. Now, let's look at all-cause mortality. For every 2 additional servings of unprocessed meat, well then again, you had an increase in your all-cause mortality. Confidence interval, again, down to 1.01. If it went to 1, it would have been not significant. It would have been, we wouldn't have found anything, but that doesn't make headlines. It doesn't make a headline to say, we wrote a paper and it turns out that we didn't find any connection at all whatsoever with bacon, sausage, pork, red meat, chicken. We found nothing, but instead we found something and this is going to reach headlines even though the confidence interval goes down to 1.01. And what about processed meat? Oh yes, processed meat, same thing. 2 additional servings, increase in all-cause mortality, down to 1.02. But here's where it gets interesting. You see, each additional serving of chicken consumed was not significantly associated with all-cause mortality. Hazard ratio, 0.99. So, if you're following along at home, that means that you heard me correctly. If you have 2 or more servings of chicken per week, you are more likely to have cardiovascular disease, but not die. Well, that's interesting because usually the way you die, at least in America, or any country that has running water, vaccinations, and normal forms of transportation, being cars, trains, automobiles, buses, is you die of cardiovascular disease. That's how the mortality occurs. But this is saying you're going to have cardiovascular disease, but you're not going to die, which smells a little fishy. And speaking of fish, again, 2 servings of fish was not associated with all-cause mortality either. Hazard ratio 0.99. This is amazing. It's amazing that the hazard ratio 0.99 for chicken and fish, that was, it's beneficial. Don't worry about it. This is good. But if it's red meat or processed meat, well then it has a ratio 0.03. I mean, again, come on. And if you really want to get down deep with it, the hazard ratio for both chicken and fish extend to 1.01, and the hazard ratio for the red meat and the unprocessed meat extend down to 1.01. So really, you can't tell me that either one is either any different, because on a different point in time, that new 95% confidence interval means that they could be the exact same number for both of them. But I don't want to rant for too much longer. This podcast has already gone on long enough. So let's sum this up. In this study, it revealed approximately a 3 to 7% higher relative risk and less than 2% higher absolute risk of incident cardiovascular disease and all-cause mortality over the 30 years of follow-up. People who consume more servings per week would have greater risk. Why is this paper wrong? Why do I think this paper wrong? Well, there's some big problems here, and that is the risk of cardiovascular disease and mortality are determined by a range of factors, including but not limited to genetic predisposition, demographic factors, socioeconomic status, weight, lifestyle, smoking, sleeping, physical activity, diet, and the environment around you. Overall, this study combined 6 studies into one, and when you looked at them, there was a huge amount of heterogeneity. People could eat all sorts or amounts of meat. There was no just 2 slices and 2 slices only. No, people were eating, like me, a whole package of bacon. There wasn't any, we're only going to look at these individuals that only consumed 1 serving or 2 servings, or people were eating all kinds of servings. There was also a problem with food preparation methods, which were not consistently and universally assessed across all the studies. Therefore, it's hard to separate fried chicken and baked chicken. It's hard to separate grilled chicken and Popeye's fried chicken, if you know what I'm saying. It was all just chicken, which makes it very difficult to tell of what is the real benefit here. Maybe the real benefit is actually fried chicken, and we just have no idea. And
They used questionnaires. We know people lie to be healthier on questionnaires, just like patients lie to providers. Not because they mean to, but because they don't want to get it wrong. They don't want to disappoint us. And finally, last but certainly not least of all my gripes about the study is that they only use baseline diet data, which was analyzed from the 6 studies. 19 years of follow-up, but only used one, yes, one questionnaire for each study. Only one dietary measurement was used. If you live in the rain one day and you look outside, you may say to yourself, well, it must rain every day, except for in a year from then, that same exact day, it might be sunny or it might be snowy. It might be all kinds of things. But to only use one dietary measurement over a 19-year study seems absolutely ridiculous, to be honest. And I'm not sure which is better. I'm not sure whether processed, unprocessed, chicken or fish is better. But the real answer is likely, as I've stated before in this podcast, eat more real food and eat less food. So when you eat, make sure it's real. And when you eat, eat less of it. If you can describe your food in detail, then you're doing okay. I picked an apple from a tree and I ate it. But if you can't, like this apple went to a machine, it was pressed, it was compounded, it was added a few chemicals, it went to another machine, it's probably not good for you overall. And with that being said, I will end this episode. I will end this episode as I have ended every one before it. Here we go. Let's wrap it up in a nice little summary. This is a long one, so I will try to go quick. Here we go. Article number one was talking about prior authorizations. Yes, prior authorizations. I think the big thing, big take home there is it's 2020. How do we not have in every single patient's chart what is formulary for each insurance? It can't be on us nor the patient to remember that. And let's be honest, in the end here, the patient is the one that loses because if they're stuck in limbo, about a third of the time, they're not picking up their script. If you're worried about getting an MRI because of the gadolinium contrast, well, have no fear. You're probably fine. You can get it. Just use the type 2 agents for gadolinium contrast. You can call down to your MRI or radiologist and make sure that they use type 2, or realistically, it's probably already just naturally going to be used. You don't have to worry about it. But if you want to be safe, go ahead and call down there. The nutrition data. The nutrition data is absolutely terrible. What you do actually matters. Eating healthy, living a healthy lifestyle actually matters. In fact, it saves you about 10 years of disease-free life. To me, this was the article of the century because you can sit to your patient and you can say, listen, you're 50 years old. If you want to live an extra 10 years disease-free life, then you got to start eating healthy, living healthy, exercising, not smoking, doing all the things that make it so you can live longer, healthier, and happier. And likely when you're talking about eating healthy, make sure they know it matters what you eat. It doesn't necessarily matter if it's low fat, high carb, low carb. It matters the quality of the fat and the quality of the carbs going into your body. But it doesn't matter the quality of the fruit carbs that are put in your body when you have prostate cancer, or at least not in this study. But it doesn't mean that you can eat anything you want if you have prostate cancer. It just means that as far as fruit and vegetables, there's probably no protective benefit there. And last but not least, the study that was looked at the nutrition data for processed meat. It made all kinds of headlines and it said, this is what we need to do. Process headlines, processed meat. We need to go ahead and just look at this. Eat more fish. That must be the answer. Except for we can't separate out fried chicken and normal chicken. We didn't use a universal data or universal source of this is exactly how you prepare your food. We only asked people in 19 years one time what kind of food they were eating. Maybe people were eating a whole bunch of chicken and then the next year they became vegetarian and were not eating chicken. Man, there's all kinds of things, all kinds of problems with this. And when you look at the upper confidence interval for fish and chicken, it matched with the lower confidence interval for processed meat and unprocessed meat. This is not a study saying that it is better or it's safer to eat fish and chicken. This is just a twist of the numbers. And you should also not have your mind twisted by this incredibly terrible data. But after all, as I've said, all nutrition data is quite terrible. And in the end, you should probably just eat better, eat real, and eat less. And with that being said, I will end this podcast as I've ended every podcast before it. Until next time, wait for the music. Here we go. Until next time, keep the quest and questioning.